Welcome to a special edition of Beyond the Nest, University of Minnesota Rochester's alumni podcast. I'm Mark Olantz. In today's episode, we hear from Evan Doyle, UMR class of 2013, as he chats with fellow Raptor alum Rachel Seisler. The two touch on a wide range of topics, from what brought Evan to UMR to his capstone experience and the work he does now in the global health policy space. Stay with us, won't you?
You and I were fortunate enough to be one of the first couple classes to come to UMR. And you were, in fact, the first class to graduate.
Yes, I was.
10 whole years ago.
I know. It makes me feel old.
Yeah, I know. It's like, wow, where did the time go?
Yeah.
We've been friends for like 12 years.
Has it been 12 years already? Yeah. That makes me feel older.
Do you remember the first time we met?
Actually, you are still saved in my phone.
I still am.
Yeah, you are. Oh, no. From we met at a party at Bridge Street. Bridge Street was the first year housing back then. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys threw the party.
Oh,
and
did we?
We were the the old ones on campus.
I never threw parties.
Crashed that party. You took my phone and wrote your name as Rachel, my little Asian fresh.
Oh, no.
And 12 years later, still on my phone.
That didn't age well, I don't think.
No, it didn't, no.
Can you describe UMR in three words?
Innovative, challenging, professional.
Oh my gosh, that's exactly how I would have described UMR.
Wow.
Yes. Maybe it's because it used to be the slogan of yes.
And somehow we incorporated that into like the student government's constitution.
Brand. Talk a little bit about maybe what drove you to choosing the University of Minnesota Rochester.
Sure. So I grew up in a very tiny town in South Dakota, and I was very determined to get out of that town and out of South Dakota. And so the pathway that I understood would be solid to pursue would be a medical doctor. So when I was choosing undergraduate programs, UMR was at the top because they were very focused on health sciences. It was a brand new campus at the time. I was in the first class, and they had a really innovative approach to how they were designing curriculum. They were very excited for the new class to come on board. So I really chose it for those reasons, that the energy around the new campus that was popping up.
What sort of extracurriculars did you do in college?
Well, okay, let me just go back to, so it was kind of a risky decision. I think as an 18-year-old, you don't think of risk in the same way as you do, you know, as a 32-year-old now. And so for me, I saw those risks as more opportunities. Challenges didn't seem like big barriers. They seemed to me at the time as, you know, a formal path hadn't been carved yet. So there weren't very many barriers in my way for doing whatever I wanted, and more opportunity to push boundaries too. So when I enrolled, there weren't any clubs, there weren't any organizations yet. So and I was always very into politics and governance, and I was in student government when I was in high school. So one of the big things that I pursued when I joined UMR was to start a student government. So we started with a student activities committee. I think that was the first thing. Basically, we started that committee just to spend this student activities budget that had taken out of our tuition. So we started there. Then the university system said you need to have a student senator. So then I moved over to being our student senator. Then the director of student activities, I think was his title at the time, said, you know, you have all these kind of random governance structures that are cropping up, so you should probably have one formalized student government. So I got a bunch of friends together. We drafted a constitution and some bylaws, and we created a student government, which I'm very happy to see on the website is still going. That's the Rochester Student Association. So then I served as the first president for, I think it was two terms.
So you built out the bylaws and the constitution. Did you do that with help from other students or?
I think I was pretty unique in getting really excited about those kind of things. I was a bit of a nerd on about.
Were you?
Yeah, I was. I did a ton of research on how other campuses had designed their governance structures. Spoke with student leaders on other campuses. So really borrowed a lot, all my favorite parts from other constitutions, especially in the U system. And then my friends who would put up with me. I forced them to kind of proofread things, get some agreement. I held a town hall where I went, I projected the Constitution and like made everyone read it on the screen. More so that, and I said, I think feel like I said this so many times, I didn't want this to be Evan Doyle's Constitution. This needed to be, sure, you know, our actual student Constitution. Right. And so I forced that engagement, whether they liked it or not.
Right. And one that was comparable to, at the very least, the other U of M system campuses and what they upheld for their student governments on their campuses.
It lended some legitimacy to us within the university system, but it also provided us, the students at UMR, knowing that the cohorts would just grow and grow and institutionalize over time. Yeah, it created that framework for us to make sure the students would in the future have representation within faculty decision-making and staff decision-making and formal mechanisms for spending that budget. From the beginning, I had always been thinking there are ways that this campus, the student body, the organization would evolve that I could not predict. So the goal was always to create some kind of framework that would be a living document, an organization that would have the engagement and the representation across the student body that would allow those decisions to be made. Mm-hmm. And clearly it's evolved with the needs of the time. That makes me very happy.
Yeah. Alongside your academics, how did you balance that?
Well, it didn't really feel like something I needed to balance, I suppose. It was something I was passionate about and excited about, interested in. And my sense at the time, which I observing from afar now as the campus has grown, that UMR really had a culture of professionalism. And for me, although that, I mean, professionalism doesn't necessarily mean that we were all squares. I hope that I'm not so much a square. But there was just a certain level of diligence. Is diligence the right word?
Yeah.
Where?
Discipline?
Discipline. Yeah. Discipline. Where, I mean, of course, like I was there to study. I was there to do well in my courses, to move on to the next phase of my life. But I made sure to leave room for the things that I was interested in as well. And I applied that same level of discipline both to the coursework as I did to my extracurriculars.
Do you feel that the group of students that you moved through your undergraduate education with also had a similar sense of, you know, pioneerism to them. Knowing that, like, all of you were, you know, we talk about risk, all of you put your eggs into this UMR basket that really didn't have a whole lot to, you know, show at that point. Hmm.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're all doing quite different things. So I think that speaks to how, you know, there was very loose path that UMR had set out for us. And because it was a new program, was evolving in real time, which we had to be really adaptable to. But I really think it gave us the flexibility to explore what we were interested in and not to get so stuck on, you know, I have to do this, I have to do that, because it's expected of me. And I'm so zeroed in on this final goal that I don't have flexibility to pursue other things that I'm interested, or get sidetracked and find a completely new interest either, right?
Yeah.
And I think that really came to fruition in the capstone, because I remember at the time my class was the first year to do capstones and there weren't a ton of rules. Mm-hmm. And in my case, I took advantage of those very few rules to do something really humongous, which spanned, I think, a longer period of time than most capstones did. But I know other friends who didn't do what I did. They did something that fit more.
Sure. We're going to get into the capstone briefly, but I did want to just kind of reflect on the idea of this professionalism with UMR. I mean, it is such a unique campus, and unlike a lot of campuses where there's sports, there's tons of clubs to involve in, you know, our campus certainly has those different unique opportunities of intramurals and starting your own club. But on top of that, it's this idea that those extracurriculars are built off of internships and mentorships and opportunities that professionally are going to drive students in the direction they need to go in order to pursue their career endeavors. So, I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I do remember, and again, this is 10, to 14 years ago now that I'm thinking back.
You're so old.
I know. Yeah, I know. I do remember that one of the big draws for me to UMR was its proximity to Mayo Clinic and how ingrained the medical field is in this community. And I remember at the time we had courses that were specifically for career exploration, which I found very valuable. I think the way that I thought about them at the time is much different than I think about them in retrospect. At the time, I thought, okay, this is going to be the vehicle for getting a job or getting into medical school or getting into graduate school, when in reality, it was more a training ground for how to interact with people out in the real world and how to seek out those kind of exposures to other perspectives and what options are out there.
Sure.
Because without that kind of exposure, I think it's really easy to get on one track and just focus on medical school, for example.
Right.
And I know friends who, and it's not just medical school, I know friends who get on that one track and realize a bit too late, oh, that's not for me. And then they feel
then
like, then yeah. yeah, then what? Then yeah. they have a bit of an existential crisis.
For sure. I mean, so what I'm hearing is that it wasn't A is going to get me to B, which is going to get me to C. It's rather A is going to provide an opportunity for me for X, Y, and Z,
yes.
right?
Yeah. Or provide exposure to learn about Z, which I didn't even know existed to begin
sure.
with.
Sure. Huh.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I think the way that I thought about my capstone again was this is a vehicle to bolster my resume for medical school. Mm-hmm. And spoiler for the end of this podcast, I didn't go to medical school and I'm not a medical doctor. but at the same time, I did not get a job through my capstone by any means. However, I think that it enriched my CV in a way, but it also gave me a perspective of the world and allowed me to pursue things that I realized through that I was interested in. So what I did for my capstone, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing, you know, everything, because I'm not sure it's always useful to do absolutely everything. But I first did the summer between my junior and senior year. I reached out to a nonprofit in Ecuador and set up a research project with them where they essentially helped me recruit study participants. I did key informant interviews around the country with health professionals to understand the barriers in access to healthcare. So it was a qualitative study.
How did you find that internship opportunity?
Google.com.
Oh.
And it wasn't an internship either. The summer before, actually, I can go back. The summer before, I had spent doing volunteer work in Kenya. And that was more for me. I was interested in traveling, but also like doing something that I could continue to explore the medical field. And that also was through Google.com. Mm-hmm. I found, I don't even want to say it was a program because it wasn't even that structured. It was more like, we'll place you with a host family, we'll introduce you to a local district hospital, and they will set you up with a volunteer opportunity. So through that experience, I realized, okay, it's actually a bit easier to go abroad and explore my interests. And so I decided to design my capstone around that. So the next summer, when I went to Ecuador, I Googled, you know, what were the kind of nonprofits that had language programs, because I was interested in improving my Spanish, and had some level of connection with clinics around the country and some level of national spread. So I reached out to the executive director. I said, listen, I'm interested in designing this research project. Have you ever, you know, worked with any kind of student researchers before? He at the time said, yeah, he had, but they didn't have much connection with, you know, universities. So the traditional kind of IRB approval, which is like the body that oversees like rubber stamping research projects, I knew probably was not in the cards for this project. So I worked with some professors at UMR to make sure that the research itself would be non-invasive enough to not need IRB approval. So I think it was framed as a quality improvement project. Mm. But it gave me the exposure to healthcare in a foreign country,
sure.
and the ability to dissect like really how a health system worked, which is what I was interested in at the time. So I spent the summer basically traveling around Ecuador, improving my Spanish and interviewing healthcare workers about what they perceived to be barriers in access to care.
Was that difficult? Was it something you felt like you had to step out of your comfort zone to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's just no one wants to look like an idiot and what they look like they don't know what they're doing. But that's really how you find these things, is to just suck up your pride and ask as many people as possible, and eventually you'll be guided in the right direction. I can't tell you how many rejections I've had on many of things that I've tried to pursue.
I feel like this is going to be the sound bit that they use in the beginning of the podcast. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Rejection's my middle name, yeah. But yeah, I mean, that ended up working out fine. I mean, it didn't go... I mean, in my mind, when I designed it, I was going to do this big, robust research project. I was going to publish all these things. But I had to scale that back because IRB approval wasn't feasible. And a lot of the interviews were in Spanish, and my Spanish was not good enough to... Oh. did it. I translated them and whatnot, but it wasn't the quality that, sure. Was publishable by any means.
Were you denied or... said no.
Oh, plenty of people that I met in Ecuador were like, no, I don't have time for this.
So you just BS. But here we are. Got your capstone done. So what else did you do as part of that experience?
Yeah, so that was the first phase of it, was a summer in Ecuador doing that. And the way that I had conceived of this research project was I wanted to do a comparison of barriers experienced in accessing healthcare in the United States. So actually the reason I chose in Ecuador was because more about feasibility of targeting a population, an immigrant population in the US. Like what I had conceived in my mind was, the conditions before immigrating, the conditions after immigrating. So when I, again, lots of Googling, lots of sifting through census data, I realized that one of the highest concentrations of Ecuadorian immigrants is in a borough in New York City. So I'd planned to do data collection in Ecuador and then was going to do the same type of data collection in New York because I had signed up to do a student exchange at Queens College. Mm-hmm. When I was nearing the end of my time in Ecuador, I had started to reach out to clinicians in New York. And that's when a lot more rejections were coming through. And so that made me quite nervous because what I had designed this capstone around was like this kind of this two-phase research project.
Yeah.
And so in the back of my mind, I was like, what am I going to do if I get to New York and no one will talk to me and let me do this research? So I applied for a bunch of internships kind of as a backup plan. And I ended up getting two of them.
So lucky you. Not lucky. You worked hard for that.
Well, but it's also like cast a wide net, right? Because I can't tell you how many rejections I had.
Right.
And, if I hadn't been nimble at the time, because I ended up doing no interviews at all in New York, I just focused on those two internships instead. And so when I did the write-up for capstone work, the research piece was just on Ecuador. And then I was able to loosely tie the internship experiences with kind of a reflection on my time in Ecuador too. So the two internships were, one was at the Latino Commission on AIDS, and that was very focused on research again. I was in their research department. And then the other one was at the Council on Foreign Relations in their global health program.
So you had traveled prior to your capstone experience, that being traveling to Kenya for a summer.
Yep.
So was that your first taste of, going abroad and doing work or volunteering or?
The first time I went abroad was the summer after my senior year of high school. Mm-mm. I was a Midwestern ambassador of music.
Oh,
I played the saxophone and sang in the choir.
And so where did you go to play your saxophone?
All over Europe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first time I'd ever gone abroad was when I was like 18, right? This summer before I went to UMR, actually. Loved it, was looking for every opportunity to go abroad again. And so that's what kind of sparked the idea about Kenya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you just found that opportunity.
For the Midwestern Ambassadors of Music?
Oh, no, for Kenya.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
On the Google machine.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Wow, Google's such a good friend of yours.
I know.
Yeah.
It's got me through a lot.
But it's really projected what you've done with your career and your desire to be abroad. I think about... We've known each other for X amount of years, over a decade, and half of that time now you've been abroad.
Wow, it has been half now.
Yeah. What is it that you love about working abroad, being abroad?
Should I describe what I do?
Sure.
Should I describe the entire arc?
Maybe
there?
Okay. Let's back up real quick and put a little bow on your capstone experience. Okay, yeah. I mean, that's a lot to bite off and do as kind of as a pioneer of the first graduating class of UMR.
One large chunk of it was a failure, though. I never did that data collection.
Okay, yes. And so it came down to, you know, you cast this wide net you talked about. You were able to pursue opportunities in Ecuador and in New York, but some of it didn't pan out the way you wanted to. I mean, was it a piecemeal? Was it, I'm going to make this square peg fit into a round hole? Or, I mean, how did you end up summarizing that opportunity?
It was more when I encountered the round hole, I just found more square pegs around me that were close and then made the connection.
Oh.
So the kind of link between Ecuador was I explored, you know, what a healthcare system looked like. One of the internships was Latino Commission on AIDS, serving, you know, Ecuadorians are a subpopulation of that served by that nonprofit. And so I learned about from an epidemic in New York City area. I learned about the kind of barriers and access that Latinos face generally when trying to seek HIV AIDS services. And I was able to build more research skills because I got to do interviews, but for a different reason, more HIV prevention, outreach campaigns kind of stuff. But really what got me excited and moving towards my next step was that other internship at the Council on Foreign Relations, because that was much high level diplomacy in the global health space. And that provided exposure to actually one of the big projects that I worked on was dual use research of concern, which is basically doing research to make, you know, I think the case study was viruses more virulent in a lab setting, which, you know, has been a topic of conversation recently as well. Mm-hmm. And that's something that the international community has been debating for years. So those kind of like international political angles of health, I had not been exposed to before that internship. And that's really what...
The catalyst.
Yeah, that was the catalyst for me continuing to pursue both public health, but like international public health.
And perhaps the catalyst that drove the last nail into the coffin of medical school.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because up until then, when I was going to New York, it was all right, well, this is the last hurrah, then I'm going to saddle in for a lot more studying and go to medical school.
And that was a lot. I mean, I remember, you know, hanging out on the weekends and we'd come into your apartment and you'd be studying for the MCAT.
Yep.
Because that is the level of commitment that students know they need for applying to medical schools, right?
Yeah. And I ended up not applying. So I decided that was not for me.
Was that a hard pill to swallow? No pun intended.
Yeah. Well, yes, it was.
Because you worked so hard for it for a long time with that vision in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that hard work doesn't go, hard work towards anything doesn't go wasted. You can always pivot that energy towards something else. If you have worked really hard at something, chances are you have developed a lot of skills and experience that are transferable in some way to something adjacent. Public health is very adjacent to clinical medicine. Mm-hmm. And so making that pivot wasn't a challenge. And I had actually set myself up really well for career opportunities after graduation.
Join the University of Minnesota Rochester on Saturday, June 17th from Peace Plaza for a celebration honoring UMR's class of 2013 and the decades-long push to bring a U of M campus to the city of Rochester. Festivities will kick off shortly before 5 p.m. with the University of Minnesota Marching Band leading the way. Featured speakers to include UMR Chancellor Lori Carroll, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, former U of M President Bob Brunix, Chancellor Emeritus Stephen Lemkuhl, and UMR alumni Evan Doyle. We hope to see you there.
So, in doing some research on you, Evan, I did notice that kind of your first exposure to monitoring and evaluation was in that capstone experience. And that is part of your title currently, right? At the Global Fund, you are an advisor, policy, and M&E advisor. how do you say your role?
So I work for the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. We're an international organization based in Geneva, Switzerland. Basically, the way that I think about it is it's an efficient mechanism for moving money from rich countries to poor countries to fight those three diseases. I joined about 2.5 years ago now to develop the new strategy. It's a 6-year strategy. That 6-year strategy covers about a just over $30 billion allocation. And so after developing the strategy, I moved over to developing a monitoring and evaluation framework. That's what M&E stands for, which is basically how are we going to measure performance against the strategy so that we can say quantitatively or qualitatively that we're achieving the goals of our strategy. So that's what I've been doing for the last year now. And now just recently, I'm pivoting over to more policy, general policy work. So my official title is advisor in policy and M&E, but I think going forward, I'm going to be a bit more focused on just policy advice. So after graduating from UMR, I worked for a couple of years in St. Paul for a small research company. Shout out to Ofsted and Associates. Gained a lot of skills, more research skills, more just general professional skills, how to work in an office setting, how to work in a client-facing kind of setting. And then after those 2 years, I went to get my master's in public health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
How did you choose that college?
Wanted to move abroad. LSHTM is what the acronym is. It's a really great public health school. So yeah, when I looked at the big Venn diagram of abroad, expertise in public health and affordability, LSHTM fit right there in the middle. Because the other angle for anyone who's ever considering going abroad and doing a degree abroad is you can do a master's degree in 1 year rather than two. And they're typically cheaper than in the U.S.
And it's well received within the United States.
Yep. It's a very good public health school.
Not that you're in the U.S. right now.
I have not worked in the United States since graduating. But yeah, I have friends who went to LSHTM, did the same degree as me, and some are working for U.S. CDC right now or working for departments of health. Yeah. So through my master's, typically with a master's program, you do a thesis. And again, so really the capstone experience at UMR, while I had many classmates in grad school who were very stressed out about the thesis and because you have to essentially design a project, I did not find it very stressful at all because I had just gone through it at UMR. And because, again, UMR was so flexible on what I could design. And because I had designed a massive project, it felt a little easier in master's program because they were much more specific on the requirements of it. So what I designed my thesis around was at the time, the United Kingdom was considering revising its policy on blood donation for, the technical term is men who have sex with men, but it's essentially gay and bisexual men. Historically, especially after the AIDS crisis of the 90s, men who have sex with men were completely barred from donating blood, not just in the United Kingdom, but in the United States as well and around the world. That policy was revised in the early 2000s to be a one-year deferral policy. So meaning that if you are MSM and you've had sex with someone else within the last year, you cannot donate blood. And so it was kind of a window of opportunity because I was very interested in understanding up close how policy reform happened, how policy reviews happened, how reform could happen, and the evidence that's used to reform policy. So I reached out to the group that was mandated to review that policy. I had a ton of coffees with people all over London to understand all the angles of what would go into that policy review. I'd looked at the terms of reference, and I designed my thesis around answering those questions that the policy review would ask. So through that experience, I was able to feed my findings from my thesis into that policy review, and they ended up revising that policy. Actually, they revised it down. They didn't revise it fully to what my recommendations were at the time. I think they revised it to a 4-month deferral. So this was 2016. Now, I think a couple years ago, they have gone all the way and revised it to what my original policy recommendations had been. So now they have a behavior-based deferral policy. So after graduate school, I was interested in moving back into like a more low and middle income settings, country settings, and working with governments, working on health policy still, and eventually moving back into HIV prevention. So
that was an interest that you wanted to continue
pursuing. Yeah. That angle between human rights, between policy, between evidence-based policymaking, I really had gotten a taste for it, and I wanted to continue with that. So after graduate school, I joined an organization called the Clinton Health Access Initiative. It's a nonprofit that basically works with governments in low and middle income countries on developing and implementing health policy. So my first job with them was in a small country called Eswatini. It's mm-hmm. a country in Southern Africa. I worked on their health financing program, basically finding efficiency opportunities for scaling up their universal health coverage policy. So a lot of work on supply chains, making sure that drugs were accessible at health facilities. My big thing at the time was infection prevention and control, actually. My big push was let's get soap and paper towels in all the hospitals, which we were moderately successful at. But a lot of the work that we did at the time, which was in 2018, was used in 2020 when at the drop of a hat, the entire country needed to get as much soap to health facilities as possible. Hmm. So I spent a couple of years doing that. And then I moved over to a regional role in Johannesburg, South Africa. I was a regional manager on the global HIV prevention program. So my job was to work with primarily four countries, South Africa, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Kenya, on introducing and scaling oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP is what we call it, which is a pill that if you take it every day, prevents HIV. Hmm. So yeah, it was a bit of a hectic job because I was I was in a different country every other week. And so a lot of the things I did was I would go and work with governments on figuring out, you know, what did the policy environment need to look like in order to introduce this product? Were the supply chains working? Were we procuring the right amount of drugs? How could we quantify to save money on different health products and drugs? Training healthcare workers to make sure that they knew how to deliver the drugs.
How big was your team?
So I was the only one in my regional role, but each of those four countries had 3 to 4 staff that I was working with directly. So it's that 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you find that it was hard to grapple with just access to resources and this desire to, you know, put things that honestly we take for granted here in the U.S. healthcare system, soap and paper towels into hospital settings? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it was stressful because it was in an area that the global community had agreed for years was very important, and it just wasn't
important on paper.
It was well, yeah. I mean, we as a global public health community have known that HIV, mm-hmm. AIDS a decade ago, HIV now, because largely we as a global community have gotten our arms around AIDS. Thankfully, people are not dying at in as great a number of AIDS as they previously were, but people are being infected at very alarming rates of HIV every day. Mm-hmm. And this was a pill that, if just taken every day, could prevent HIV. So I found it exhausting and frustrating because we as a global community we knew that this was something that could really make a difference. And there was money available for aspects of it, but oftentimes the response wasn't joined up and well coordinated. Oh. And a lot of my job was just trying to get all the dots
tethered.
Yes. And to make a connection back to UMR, I actually found the connections that we were often making across coursework and that aversion to working in silos and working in isolation and thinking in a cross-disciplinary way to be really beneficial to the way that I worked. Because as I've progressed through my career, I've noticed that that's not the natural tendency of a lot of people in their fields. People become experts in their given area and are very comfortable to stay in that little box.
Right.
But there often isn't an incentive to work across lines in that way.
So was it well received?
Yeah. I mean, just to take South Africa as an example, we were successful in, I built a model. Thanks, Dr. Huck, for teaching me Excel. Mm-hmm. I built a model to basically make the financial case for scaling PrEP. So scaling meaning putting PrEP in all clinics in the country, public clinics. There are about 3,500 clinics. At the time, there were about 100 clinics that were providing PrEP. We wanted to put it in all of them, and that made the financial case to do it. We were able to convince the Treasury to make that domestic investment. We got the go-ahead in October 2019. Then we went all steam ahead to scale. We got through, I think, just through phase two of scaling. So that was just over 1,000 clinics in like a 4-month period. And then COVID hit. And so a lot of our work just got pivoted towards the COVID response. So at that time, that was when I, you know, myself needed to think through a pivot for my career, because like a lot of public health programs, as important as the COVID response was, public health in general has been a chronically underfunded field.
And it was like a drop everything, and this is what we're focusing on now.
Yes, yes. Right. And so that's really what catalyzed my move to Global Fund after that. And I, you know, I still keep in touch with my friends and colleagues in South Africa in particular, because that's put so much blood, sweat, and tears into that program. And because they've continued to scale, and now I believe they've passed 3,000 clinics. So we're very happy about that. Uptake has, if you look at there's an exponential curve in uptake of PrEP now. So yeah, the program's doing very well. It just really, we hit a real barrier with when COVID hit. And so it was time for me to move on to at that point.
Nonetheless, it was able to be picked up again after COVID scare had, you know, put a little more under control, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's amazing too to think that all that progress that you had prior to or pre-pandemic was able to continue after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing about public health. I'm biased. I think some of the best people work in public health. People are just really passionate, really smart. And just because, you know, we might encounter in our respective focus areas in public health a setback, that doesn't necessarily mean that priority goes away. There are still really passionate, hardworking people that will continue to advocate for those areas. And those, you know, those priorities will continue to be advanced. And that we've seen that in PrEP programs around the world. We now have PrEP products that are a bit more long acting. So you don't have to take pills every single day, that are coming down the pipeline. So the future is very bright for HIV prevention.
Hmm. So then, have we talked yet about what you currently do within your role?
Yeah. So like I said, I joined Global Fund to work on the strategy. But generally, I think that my role, both on strategy, M&E, and policy, the day-to-day is quite the same. Those really high-level, kind of globally focused roles it's a lot of diplomacy skills, a lot of stakeholder coordination, and a lot of, you know, just get things done. So a lot of what I do is, you know, kind of defining an agenda, defining an outcome that we need to get to.
Project management.
Yeah, a lot of project management skills. A lot of bringing people along the way, building consensus. A lot of things that we did at UMR when building the first student government.
Sure.
On the policy side now, that's mostly what I'm going to be working on. Where Global Fund's at on the funding cycle, now we have just over 100 recipient countries that will be applying for funding for this next round. So this will be coming out in the next few months. During that period, various policy-related issues will come up when funding applications come through, and I'll be supporting on figuring out the eligibility of countries to receive funding for their programs.
Do you have any advice for students who are looking to study abroad or, you know, in the future work abroad?
I mean, my advice is not to be convinced of the boxes that society puts you in, just because, like, when you flip through the different options for study abroad programs, if what you want to do isn't in that catalog that you're looking through, or if the country is not on the list, don't interpret that as like, this is your only options. You can't do that. I never did a formal study abroad program, and not to knock the study abroad programs. I know that I've known people who did them, and they really found them valuable, and they loved it. And actually, like, it's a shortcut for a lot of things. They wouldn't have had to go through as much stress as me sometimes, like getting stranded in random tiny villages and like having to figure out how to find transport back to civilization.
I don't think that's university condoned.
Yeah, right. But like in my case, I didn't see barriers. If what I was interested in wasn't readily apparent, I would find a way to do it. You know, there aren't as many rules to life as, you know, you might think there are. And just because you don't have a template for it in front of you doesn't mean that a template doesn't exist. So you should always like ask other people, do Googling. Don't be afraid to just buy a plane ticket to a random country and go yourself, because generally things will work out.
How do you navigate, you know, feelings of doubt or...
I think it's important to stay grounded with your friends at all walks of life. For me, I've lived in 4 countries in the last 6 years now, and 5 countries, actually, if you call it the United States. And so I, you know, have made really great friends all along the way. And I've found it really grounding to always like keep in close contact with my friends and my family. But usually my friends are following a little bit more closely, like what is going on in my life. And I'm not sure, I don't know that you ever fully get over imposter syndrome, because for me, it's every, you know, kind of new challenge that I encounter or new kind of network that I break into that I didn't really know existed, I look around and I kind of question, like, okay, well, this can't actually be the all the people that like are doing these really important things, or I can't be one of the people that's responsible for doing this really important thing. So like, there, I don't know, someone made a mistake. But what I'd like learned along the way is really people are just people everywhere. And if you work hard, you don't even have to be that smart. If you work hard and if you're nice and if you like persevere through things, generally those are the people that run the world, really.
Thank you to Evan and Rachel for their quite thorough conversation. And thank you for listening to Beyond the Nest, UMR's alumni podcast. Beyond the Nest is produced by UMR Alumni Relations and edited by Marshall Saunders of Minnesota Podcasting. Beyond the Nest will be taking a couple months off for some much-needed rest and recuperation, but we'll be back in September with an all-new season. Until then, toodaloo.